You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko jol toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for today. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Vihan. E whai akane, coming up on the show. For Dear Science this week, our expert Dr. Kushla McGovern chats with us about food waste and strategies for limiting waste, the five stages of brain development, and scientists using E. coli to create rainbow dye. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke to MP Stuart Smith about the substantial changes to regional councils and Health Minister Simeon Brown's calls to decentralise Health New Zealand. For Green World, Tuesday Wire host Sarah spoke to Dr. Sei Wing Yui, a wildlife ecologist at the Bioeconomy Science Institute, about this week's wildlife conference in Queenstown. And I spoke to Peter Saxton, an associate professor in social and community health and HIV researcher at the University of Auckland, about the Ministry of Health's HIV monitoring report that was released yesterday. Vihan, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Sam Polisi, a doctoral candidate at the University of Auckland, about his study on burnout within New Zealand-born Pacific communities.
He aho whakaro. Let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces by getting in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 3 toru iwa 5395, or wai mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 3 kore iwa 3 8 7 9. Mena kei te pirangi koutou ki te whakarongo ki ēnei uingue, ki etahi uingue rānei i runga i te waia, haere mai ki tō mātou pai tukutuku ko irirangi poho 95bfm.com. If you want to listen to any of these interviews or any of the interviews from our show, The Wire, just head to our website 95bfm.com. Kia timata te whakatūranga. Let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We're joined again by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. How about yourself?
Good. Very hungry. It's been a very, very intense day over here at the station. The weather's not looking too grand either, but we have some very interesting topics today, don't we? Food waste and strategies for limiting food waste. I feel this is quite important, and it's, you know, we've seen a push for this quite recently.
Yeah, no. So this is so there is a bit of a sustainability theme to a couple of the stories today, food waste and textiles. And this paper that we're talking about in relation to food waste is actually not a scientific research paper, but a comment paper, which was when you have some experts in an area that write their opinions, or they're making a comment basically. And it is, because food waste is a major problem. It's actually really hard to quantify as well. So you'll see some very different numbers. So this comment said that it was estimated that 19% of food is wasted, but you will see reports of 30 to 40%.
Wow.
So that's, you will, a common number is more than 1 billion tons per year globally.
Yep.
And there's a kind of an estimate that about 60% of that is at the household level.
Right. Do we know what that's looking like here in New Zealand?
Yeah. So actually, there's actually been a report just recently come out in the last couple of months. I think it was, or comes out of the Ministry for Environment. And they've said that each person in New Zealand is an average of 230 kilograms per year.
That's crazy.
That is crazy,
that
right?
That is mental.
It's 1.2 million tons in total. What's really interesting about this, though, is they're saying that's like basically about 5 to 10%, but it doesn't account for exports, right? So we export a lot of food in New Zealand. So if we looked at it as like globally where our food went, and then it would probably be a bit higher as a percentage.
Yeah.
But 237 kilos a year, like,
that is ridiculous.
Yeah, it
that's
is
insane.
In New Zealand, it's also, they did say that actually it's a lot at the primary production stage. So because we grow a lot of food, that it's a less heavily weighted on the household level.
Okay,
so
yep.
There is, you know,
so
there's a little bit of difference.
So it's at a consumer level than it is just, you know. Okay,
consumer level, still got problems, but a lot of,
yeah.
And so what this paper was really about was, you know, why is this a problem? What's kind of going on? And so, because, you know, obviously it is a big financial cost, and
I don't know what that is. We'll sort that out. Let's just carry on, though.
Okay. And it does contribute to greenhouse gas emissions, right, with, you know, this food degrading and stuff, and just being waste in the landfill. And so the UN actually has its sustainable development goals, and one of them is actually to halve household food waste by 2030. And the UK, that does pretty well in this space, has managed to have a 22% reduction in food waste if you compare 2007 to 2022. So that's good, but it's nowhere near half, right? There's a lot of work to do. And so why is this such a problem? And it comes down to, it's very behavioural, and it's a complex system. And so this is always hard to change. You know, it's something you have to keep working at. It's not like, you know, with COVID, we could go and get vaccines and diminish the problem. It's still a problem, but it's, you know, it's not as big a problem as it was when we were all locked down.
Yeah.
Food waste, you've just got to keep at it, right? Yeah. You can't, it's not one and done. Yeah. You can't avoid it. We all need to eat.
Yes.
There's always going to be some food waste.
Yes.
And so that's part of the problem as well. And then it's just reducing something is always hard. So in the behavioral research, they use the terms approach behavior and avoidance behaviors. And so approach behaviors are easy to promote. So this is like, it's easier to encourage someone to eat well than it is to promote them to waste less food. And so because of these things and the fact that it's got a variety of determinants, so you can think of it at an individual level. Maybe you just don't like the look of the leftovers in the fridge, so you don't eat them.
Yeah.
Maybe you're a family and you've got a child that's got a bit of a fickle appetite, and so you get the waste there. Or, you know, you have the wider environment. You've got no time, so you can't food prep, so you buy the takeaways and stuff.
Yeah.
And then these things all end up interconnected as well. You had a bad day at work. You just want some takeaways so you don't eat the food that's in the fridge that you meant to prepare.
I understand that very well.
And all these things, right? And so this all contributes to this problem, and it's this complex system. And so what this comment paper is kind of is pointing out, that this is why it's difficult, and giving some suggestions on the levels with which this problem should be approached.
Yep.
And we are seeing some of this in New Zealand. As you said, we have heard a lot about this recently. The previous Juliet Gerard, she's the Prime Minister's science advisor. I can't remember the proper title.
Yeah.
She did a lot of work. Her office did a lot of work around waste and stuff. And so basically there's six suggestions come to visibility. First one, know how much you're wasting. You know, if you are reducing, like, see how effective it is. So you can think, in, we have these compost bins now, right, that you can put your waste in. So you can start to see your food waste a little bit more easily. There is a little bit of a catch to that, when sometimes human nature and behaviour is such that if we think it's being repurposed, so we're like, oh, it's going to compost, that's great.
Yeah.
We don't need to make an effort to reduce it now, right, because it's going to something else. It's not quite the right thinking, like it is still all this energy that was put into growing this food or preparing it, you know, and that. So we do have to be a little bit careful with how we use those systems, but it's a good system, you can see. Comparison, like usually we say comparison is the thief of joy, but in this case comparison is a good thing in terms of what would you expect. You're always going to have food waste, but are you having a lot or are you doing pretty well? And so, you know, we need to know what would be expected. And so this is you know, generally going to be on a level probably beyond the household, and, you know, then it needs to be communicated. So whether that's government or community groups that do this, things like understanding and opportunity was the other class they have. So this is your knowledge of labels. So best before versus used by, right? Used by is you use it by that date that's given because of health and safety reasons. But best by is because after that date, that's the best by date. It lowers in quality, but health-wise, health and safety-wise, it's still probably okay for a little bit. Motivation, so how do we influence how people feel about food waste and stuff? And so New Zealand's got some really good groups that are around this. There's the Aotearoa Food Rescue Alliance, which does a lot of work with a lot of other groups, like supermarkets and stuff, to try and minimise food waste and redistribute it to people who need it. Because this is what's kind of perverse about the problem as well.
Yeah.
We get a lot of food waste, but we've got a lot of people going hungry too.
Yeah.
And that's kind of dumb.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's just dumb.
Yeah.
And so, and then looking at, you know, things like, that apple is not really perfect looking, but it's still fine to eat, right? We kind of like that consumer behavior, and they're getting over that. And so regulation is another thing that, you know, and that's more government level. So You know, we have these profit-driven systems that encourage kind of overpurchasing and overconsumption, right? So, you know, we all go to the supermarket. We love a two-for-one deal because we think we're getting a bargain.
Yeah.
But do we really need it? Are we going to eat those two heads of broccoli or did we only need one
kind
of thing?
Yeah.
And then there's just the, you know, the wider system goal, which is very much the government level, where the government's putting in measures and prioritising things like minimising food waste over perhaps economic growth and things like this.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Interesting. Now, I think we only have time for one more topic just because we're a little bit, we have quite a packed show today. But what I would want to talk about is the bacteria produce and colour fabric because I had a quick read of that. Using E. coli to make rainbow dye? How does that work?
Yeah, so this is, again, sustainability, textiles. We have fast fashion, big problem, right? We all know this. It's something crazy like a single cotton T-shirt requires 2,700 litres of water to grow that cotton, which is basically one person's drinking needs for 2.5 years.
That's insane.
Yeah, and so there's been a lot of work around alternative methods of production and stuff. And so often when we look at alternative methods of production, bacteria are our... where we go. Right. These factories, right?
Yeah.
And so what a lot of bacteria can do is produce cellulose. Cotton is largely composed of cellulose. And the bacteria do this to form biofilms and protective measures and stuff. But it comes out white. And so there's this group that went, okay, well, then usually we would have to take that cellulose and then we'd have to go and dye it. And that can be a lot of energy and processing and chemicals and contamination of soil and water.
Mm.
Bacteria also produce pigments. Why don't we use the bacteria as well to do this? And so this is where the E. coli is. Different strains of E. coli will produce different pigments, and they'd fall into two groups called violacines, which produce your purples, your blues, and your greens. And then you've got other strains that produce carotenoids, which are your reds and your oranges and yellows. And so basically what they did was they just had a one pot. They put in a bacteria. There wasn't E. coli, but it was producing the cellulose. And then they put in their pigment producing E. coli, and it basically dyed the cellulose. And then they bring it out of the pot, and they've got a fabric, well, a dyed cellulose that they would then probably have to process into a fabric. But what they were able to show, it's pretty stable against acids and bases and heat treatment and washing. They do need to test its durability against like detergents and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's pretty cool because you could get your coloured fabric or material just out of a pot of bacteria.
It's just really kind of scary to think about. I mean, how many people out there would be keen to pick up a bacteria-coloured shirt?
But this is the thing. Like, we often think of bacteria as bad, like infection and everything, but they're actually really good for producing things and, you know, keeping out bad bacteria and all that. Yeah, so there.
So is this like a relatively new finding, I guess, that we could, you know, use E. coli to produce these colours in clothing?
So I guess it's... we've always known that they can produce pigments, but this is, I think, the relatively new that someone's kind of gone with this idea of, oh, we could actually produce enough of this pigment to dye like a textile-like material, yeah.
That's insane. I mean, I don't know. Vihan, would you want an E. coli-coloured shirt?
It's a pretty good colour I would wear.
Well, they are beautiful. It is the rainbow, and they're quite vibrant, so I was quite impressed.
Look, I expected to see them in AS colour soon, maybe.
Yeah.
We'll see. Well, thank you very much for your time this afternoon, Dr. Kushla McGovern. Thank you, MOTAT, obviously, and thank you, Science. Christmas lights at MOTAT. Experience Auckland's most magical Christmas lights, heritage trams, festive music, Santa visits, and thousands of sparkling lights. Tickets are available at motat.com. Thank you once again, Dr. Kushla.
Cheers.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Ka hoki mai anō, maua I muri I tēnei wehenga panui poto noho tonu. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
The world famous True School Hip Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip hop with BFM's True School. Checking in on current and historical flows, beats and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts and the one show to know.
We like the breeze float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip hop.
True School Hip Hop Show.
Who you calling a bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95 BFM.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Sheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive. Thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Hey, B card holders, we've got another tasty prize for you to win. Tickets to Bar Italia's Some Like It Hot album tour this December. Just listen to 95BFM Drive all week for your chance to win. 95BFM presents Bar Italia, the Some Like It Hot album tour. Saturday, December 13th at Hollywood Avondale. Get your tickets now at Banished Music.
Ah, guys, he finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no, what if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire here on 95BFM.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the National Party.
Recently, the government has announced some major reforms to how regional councils operate, with regional councillors proposed to be replaced by boards made up of city and regional mayors, and potentially even Crown-appointed representatives called Combined Territories Boards, or CTBs. As well as this, Health Minister Simeon Brown has called for the decentralisation of Health New Zealand, with the expectation the entity focuses on delivering closer to the front line, additionally expecting a plan to do so by the end of the year. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke to MP Stuart Smith about these topics, starting with Regional Council. Why is the government proposing these reforms to regional councils?
Oh, well, it's been a lot of duplication between the regional and district councils, and they're not the most popular entities in New Zealand, and quite often people don't even know who their councillor is, or let alone who the chair of the regional council. I'm in a fortunate position, I suppose, in that I have five councils in my electorate when you count ECAN, but one of the councils, the Marlborough District Council, is a unitary authority, which is much easier to deal with, I'd have to say, from an MP's perspective than having two councils, which complicate things. So constituents, I know, find it much easier to deal with the Marlborough District Council than with a district council and a regional council, which is often what they have to do.
RMA Minister Chris Bishop says that the proposal would also mean there would be no mandatory EB representation and that Māori constituencies would be abolished alongside regional constituencies. We've already seen at a central government level the Treaty Principles Bill result in one of the largest hīkoi in the country's history, and more recently we have seen the Regulatory Standards Bill pass, which many critics have argued breaches Te Tiriti o Waitangi. Some Māori might say this is yet another attack on Māoridom. What would you have to say to that?
No, I don't think those things are related at all, quite frankly. I think it's a very long bow.
Dr. Mahina Arangi Baker, a lecturer in Kaitiakitanga and Putaio at Te Wānanga Orokawa, says that despite the government saying treaty settlements would be carried over, she adds this is misleading as many Māori partnerships with councils were not established through settlements at all. Are you concerned that treaty settlements and ongoing relationships between Māori and the council would disappear with a move like this?
Well, I don't see why they would. Ultimately, councils are there to represent every one of their ratepayers and residents in their rohe, if you like, and that doesn't change. And each one of those constituents has equal rights to representation. There's no delineation between rights between people.
Could this lower Māori involvement and participation in local democracy?
I can't see how that would be the case, no.
With this proposal, as mentioned previously, alongside mayors, CTBs could potentially even be made up of Crown-appointed representatives. Could this indicate distrust from the central government in local government?
Oh, no, I think it indicates the government's willingness to ensure that people have adequate skills and capabilities on those CTVs. So I think it's a good move, quite frankly.
Prime Minister Christopher Luxon has previously campaigned quite heavily on the concept of localism. The Labour Party has criticised National as essentially breaking promises. Is this what we're seeing here? Are we seeing a shift to how National views localism?
No, I don't think so. That's, again, another long bow to draw. I mean, the reality is here that we've got an issue that regional councils aren't working. They're certainly not working in my area. The constituents in rural Canterbury, which goes all the way from the flats of Kaikoura all the way down to the Mackenzie country, including a whole lot of high country and, of course, a large urban area in Christchurch, where all of the power essentially rests with the regional council. So we see a regional council that's not responsive to the needs and wants of its, a lot of its constituents, just simply based on by the fact that they have all the representation from urban Christchurch, you know, which actually has the most polluted rivers in Canterbury, and yet they seem to ignore that and focus completely on rural Canterbury rather than actually cleaning up their mess in their own backyard.
Former Christchurch Mayor Leanne Dalziel argues on Newsroom that the proposed move would be subject to total government control with the Minister of Local Government given the final say. How would the government guarantee that local democracy still retains a fair amount of autonomy?
Well, she would say that, wouldn't she? But there's plenty of autonomy and ability for local councils to make decisions. They are elected by the representatives, and those mayors will have a say on the CTVs.
Moving on to our next topic, Health Minister Simeon Brown has called for Health New Zealand to essentially decentralise the entity. Why are we seeing these calls from the minister?
Well, because the centralised behemoth of the bureaucracy is not working, clearly. It was pulled together by the Labor government in the middle of a pandemic, which was very badly handled, and it has been a disaster, and that's hence the waiting list and the mess that Simeon's having to clean up right now. He's doing a damn good job at it, actually.
Brown expects a plan from the entity at the end of the year. What does the party hope is a part of this plan?
That we can continue to make the progress that Simeon has been making in clearing backlogs and getting the health system back on its feet. We have invested in a record amount in health, and health is a large burner-up of Kiwis' tax dollars, and we need to get that value for that money. And I'm sure that the efforts of Simeon, who's doing a fantastic job, will lead and bear fruit in the near future.
That was the National Party's Stuart Smith on the changes to Regional Council and Simeon Brown's calls to decentralise Health New Zealand.
That was our weekly chat with the National Party.
What's this button do? Whoa!
You are now entering the green world.
From today until the 4th of December, a conference will be held in Queenstown that will look into pest management and how best to protect native species. The event not only brings experts in the sector from Aotearoa, but will also involve Australian experts as well. Tuesday Y host Sarah spoke to Dr. Sei Wang Yui, a wildlife ecologist at the Bioeconomy Science Institute, about this week's conference and what to expect.
My name is Sei Wang, and I am a wildlife ecologist at the Bioeconomy Science Institute. I mostly work on in the predator space, actually, and recently also getting into some research on deer and wallabies as well. But I'm in the team of wildlife ecology and management, so a lot of the research that our team does is applied research on wildlife management, literally. Yeah, so in this year's conference, I'm going to talk about one of the projects I've been working on the last year and a half, which is trying to estimate cat population densities and also detection probabilities, which is basically how easy or how challenging it is to detect a cat when it's present in an area. So I'll be talking about some initial findings of the research because we are still kind of halfway through the whole project.
You were involved in the organizing of this conference.
Yes.
Why was it so important to bring together experts, and why is this research generally on wildlife management so important in Aotearoa?
So obviously, as a scientist, I would say that for any wildlife management issues or problems, that we should have scientifically informed strategies and planning, basically, in order to achieve successful wildlife management. So this conference is organized by the Australasian Wildlife Management Society, and this brings together experts not only just from Aotearoa, but also experts from Australia as well, actually the whole of Australasia region. Collaboration in science is always the way to progress forward in science. So it's important to bring everyone together to share ideas and to share findings. And one of the cool thing about the conference is it's not just bringing in scientists, but it's also popular among wildlife practitioners. So we don't just talk about the science, but we also understand actually the challenges that the wildlife managers on the ground are facing, and we can try to think about ideas in science to help them with more efficient management strategies.
What are you most excited about? What are you most hoping you'll get coming out of this event from other researchers maybe, or from just the collaboration or the coming together of people who are working in this space?
So I know that there's quite a few people who work in the same field as me, like trying to estimate population densities. And I mean, in my research, I've seen quite a lot of challenges actually analyzing the data. So for myself, I'm looking very much forward to connect to some of these researchers who also have experience in the same space modeling populations, and to see if they might actually be able to give me some advice or tips or their experience actually in modeling population densities.
How have technological developments in recent years changed or uplifted in a way how you do your work?
I mean, the heated topics recently have always been AI. Me, myself, I don't work a lot in the new technologies like product kind of space. But AI, for example, like use a lot of camera monitoring in our research. And for example, the AI has been helping us basically to save time in analyzing the data. Like there are lots of technologies trying to use AI to identify objects and animal species even in the pictures that we are collected. And sometimes there are even cameras that already have AI models incorporated in the camera. So when you put it out in the field, the cameras already tells you remotely if it's connected to the satellite or your cellular network, it detects an animal and it will tell you what animal it is. And in general, all these kind of new technologies is always trying to aim at more efficient and more higher efficacy in wildlife management. And I think that's the most important thing that we can get out of all these new development technologies.
What are you looking forward to in the next few years in terms of what kind of research questions or research focus you'll pursue?
In the coming years, obviously, as I mentioned, I was still halfway through the cat population density project. I would very much like to complete this project and try to project basically a map, develop the map of cat populations over the whole country. And I'm hoping that this work can help with actually prioritizing the area for cat management. And once you understand which areas have the most cats and understand which areas they are easier to detect, then the next step I would be to think to develop the relationship between cat impacts on native species and cat population density. In science, we call it the density impact function. So it's literally trying to work out the relationship of whether the higher number of cats results in higher impact of them on native species. And sometimes this relationship is not strictly linear. And understanding this would then allow us to actually have practical management goals. So you can actually think about what is the actual number of cats that we want to achieve in order to protect a certain area to achieve good biodiversity and conservation benefits. So I think that's the one thing that I would very much like to develop further in the coming years.
That was the Bioeconomy Science Institute's Dr. Sei Wing Yu on this week's Wildlife Conference in Queenstown.
That was The Green World.
This is why we should never put celebrities in charge of any... Oh, wait.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text in 5395 on any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Paint a feed, smoke your trees, build a vibe. Paint a feed, smoke your trees.
Madeline. Since I was young, I just wanted my parents to retire. That's all I cared about. I am the biggest house. Tell them I finally made it. I know they never doubt it. I seen it in my mama's eyes. She knew that her boy was about it, about it. It ain't my option to fail, I gotta prevail. But only in time it reveals the weight of the arches I put on the scale. The weight of the world, but the vision is clear. Daytona, I just be racing around. Daytona, baby, we gotta get out. Daytona, baby, they proud of me now.
I got a mic in my hand.
The world need change like my daughter nappy. I'll do anything to make my daughter happy. These rappers rappy, but they sort of cappy. It's on the rap game, you should call me daddy. Two Zoom calls and a FaceTime. Make the same face once the bars hit the baseline. I'm a different breed, we ain't the same kind. But I'm compassionate, so I gotta stay kind.
Pay the fee, take your time, smoke your tree, feel the vibe. Mr. Killer with the line, bite your bars in a one. Pay the fee, take your time, smoke your tree, feel the vibe. Mr. Killer with the line, bite your bars in a 1v5.
I've been getting stoned, down on East Elk Road. You know how it is, you know how it goes. Only way to free the mind, only way to free the soul. Cause it's me, myself, and I, with the daily self-flow. Sitting in my room, on a pile of low clothes. Watching all the days go by, where my tears run dry. And my eyes gone red, and get out the beds. What I said to my head, but I'm lost in the thoughts of what if and then.
I'll double back and I check the scene. If I'm stepped in, I'm dripped out from head to feet. I clench my fist, my right shoulder will move back and lean. Raise one foot and tap, 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 tap concrete. You better not lock eyes on me. I'll bend 10, I'll switch up to a double G. Stop asking me where I get my drip. Most of it's from overseas. I hop on waves real early. Searching vibes, shop boutiques, and I take flight as soon as you can't. Get like me, yeah, get like me.
Pay the fee, take your time, smoke your tree, feel the vibe. Mr. Killer with the line, write your bars in a one. Pay the fee, take your time, smoke your tree, feel the vibe. Mr. Killer with the line, write your bars in a 1v5.
This the greatest shit to ever hit the speakers. It's the shit we bless the ears with so we can wake the sleepers. But don't wake the beast and come to face the militant creature. I roll with the genuine, not those who charge for features. But I love all this rap shit, still love the money like bone thugs. Life is so crazy, man, I be so busy, you lazy and we seem flawless. Creeping on, I come up with the crew, I'm not the two or three. Cause Billie Jean said I am the one.
My son hella handsome, my daughter so gorgeous. Painting a picture, my life like a portrait. Trying not to hype up the fake or the porcelain. Let go with the flow, never know me the forces. Slipping through life, had to pull with a force. If no backing up, I'ma do with a fork. Give me the money, I give an endorsement. Out on the Porsche, now we riding in Porsche. Renewing my life by the fly, metamorphic. Deep in the water, call her full of orchids. Profit few wishing, growing a few orchids.
Hey, 7 p.m. every Tuesday. Zero Henderson, West Bay Pools. Full of free pizzas and bars.
Pay the fee, take your time, smoke your tree. Mr. Killer with the line, write your bars in a one. Pay the fee, take your time, smoke your tree, feel the vibe. Mr. Killer with the line, write your bars in a 1v5.
Come through, wanna come and imitate. Cause we running too small like a legs on vacation. You two wanna come and get a taste. We can drink it too smooth if you want the medication. Come through, wanna come and imitate. Cause we running too small.
That was 7 p.m. in West Auckland by AKL Mads featuring Church, Mellow Downs, The Shogun, Habibi Double G, Hunar and Kayo. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
A new study by the University of Auckland has shown rising levels of burnout within the Pacific community. The research is the first large-scale study to examine burnout within New Zealand-born Pacifica adults between the age of 18 to 65. The study found that 90% of the adults experienced burnout, with almost 50% experiencing burnout repeatedly. I spoke to the University of Auckland doctoral candidate Asatoa Sampalisi about his study on burnout within New Zealand-born Pacific communities. What is your research about?
My research is around burnout in New Zealand-born Pacific communities, trying to look at collective responsibilities, be it in the workplace, family, community, church, so forth, and how does that integrate or interrelate and work with personal needs, health and well-being, and obviously acknowledging there are some tension points at times, and what can we do about it as a community.
So how can Pacific and other immigrant communities support young adults in their communities so as to prevent burnout?
Pacific communities, like other, I guess, migrant communities, particularly in the sort of collective sense, come to new countries, work together. Often there are sacrifices done on behalf of bigger opportunities to come. Some of the challenges that come from that is, a lot of emphasis on collective well-being, and younger people typically don't have the leadership autonomy or some of the life skills to balance that. And so then when there's a stronger emphasis on collective well-being, sometimes personal well-being can be lost. And so I think what we can do as migrant Pacific ethnic minority communities is socialise better ways of sustainable practices. How can we do things for others? But also lift the stigma around personal boundaries, personal well-being, and these ideas of what is selfish and what isn't. And so if we do that as a collective, then it takes sort of the burden off the individual having to deal with these things on their own.
So in your study, you mentioned, quote, interventions that respect Pacific values. So what do you mean by that exactly? And what would that intervention actually look like?
So in burnout literature, research, there's an emphasis around encouraging individuals to have personal boundaries, to say no, sort of lighten your load of responsibilities when you can. I guess what that doesn't account for is Pacific worldviews around what collectivism looks like, what respect looks like, particularly around hierarchy. And so when we can have interventions that understand that perhaps it's not as straightforward as just telling people to say no, look after yourself. Those don't happen on its own. And so when we build interventions in the workplace or otherwise, I think it's around taking more a communal approach to lifting the stigma around personal boundaries, around saying no, and having that role modelled in a safe and friendly way for various individuals to feel like something they can do themselves.
And what would need to happen for workplaces to adopt policies that better support its Pacifica workforce in terms of meeting their cultural and social obligations?
Continued flexible working arrangements, working from home, understanding the way in which Pacific families and communities celebrate various things, be it funerals or otherwise, and policies that sort of allow for not just this one approach of whatever annual leave and everything else looks like, and just understanding that we all come to the workplace of various or differences around cultural capital, social capital, and I think just having open conversations in the workplace is what does that look like from an employer perspective. Likewise, in terms of our colleagues, how can we better support each other in terms of what our wide responsibilities look like. I think healthy conversations in the workplace is an important step.
And similarly, what would need to happen on the policy front?
I think on the policy front, it's also trying to allow for funding mechanisms or sort of other approaches, allow for interventions or resourcing in a way which supports that it's not always a one-size-fits approach for encouraging health and well-being outcomes across communities. And so be it from government or sort of other funders, those sort of shifts or those sort of more inclusive ways of understanding how people live their lives and what's important to them will enable Pacific communities themselves to take ownership of balanced and sustainable lived practices per se, but also enable the communities around them, be it workplaces, churches, community groups, to sort of support these efforts as well.
And can you talk a little bit more about the practice of giving money with little to no boundaries and where that sort of stems from and its implications on young adults and families?
Typically, burnout doesn't measure these sort of things, burnout studies. However, based on our community engagement and co-design, as people acknowledge that our financial giving is part of collectivism and generosity to others and part of, I guess, the social fabric of our families and communities, understand sharing resources is important. And so people were interested to consider or investigate does that play a role in burnout or influence somehow, be it sort of stress, things that come out from sort of chronic stress. Yes, we understand that, you know, supporting others, family members, community members with our finances and other resources is important. However, what we understand is that when there's little to no boundaries at play, it can be quite dangerous, quite tricky. It's unsustainable. Giving, 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 and the cup is empty. Continue to give, obviously, they leave some gaps in terms of our health and well-being, not only just, I guess, our finances. So there's quite a yearning around trying to unpack, I guess, this correlation between love and serving, be it with our finances and stuff, and find a better way to demonstrate our love to others with our finances, but in a more sustainable approach. And again, it's not just about sort of relying on individuals to make these choices. It's about a community approach, or families per se, to talk amongst themselves and understand the importance of money and sharing with each other, but also talking to some of the realities, be it cost of living and bills and other sort of priorities at play as well. And I think families together coming to these agreements and sort of these pivots and shifts around how do we maintain our sort of cultural obligations, but also how do we stay well and also feed into the various other responsibilities that we have.
So how can immigrant Pacifica families and communities sort of begin having these sort of conversations with their extended family about the cup being empty and just not being able to give but still fulfilling the obligations? Yeah, how do they begin these conversations?
Yeah, every family is obviously really different, acknowledging most times though in our communities, in migrant communities, as a collective communities, is that there's a lot of respect given to our elders. But I guess in respect to that, I guess I'm just trying to encourage some two-way conversation between our younger people coming through and then our parents, grandparents, and how do we find the middle ground to the values that often our parents, our elders hold on to and see as incredibly important, but also how do we contextualize, I guess now, 2025 and moving forward, is that what are the various things at play in New Zealand and other sort of Western countries that we find ourselves in now. And so open dialogue, lifting the shame and stigma, learning to love each other and perhaps not fully equipped, I guess, our love for others just on the sort of amount of money that we give and share to others, and noting that there are other ways to support each other and show our love and gratefulness and reciprocity to others rather than just money.
And so what are some of the other ways Pacifica young adults can strike a balance between caring for their families and communities and also for themselves?
Personal boundaries are really important. But again, as I said, it can be easier said than done. And so I think young people perhaps need to find ways where they can do their best to serve, to give, but also refill their cup. I think it's about also understanding the change of the times per se, is that as we get a little bit older and generations change, also some of our attitudes and expectations change over time. And for some of us, we understand that our parents and their worlds will stay the same. And so we have to, I guess, negotiate that and work with that. And then over time is that, when we grow a little bit more power and autonomy to sort of influence our world around us, then those are the times that we can, move more to the middle, per se.
How can both the Pacifica and immigrant community and individuals negotiate this idea of adapting to a more liberal and individualized Western lifestyle while also staying connected to their roots and looking after the community and not just themselves as an individual?
Yeah, there's always tensions at play. I mean, and it's truthfully, it's obviously it's not at the extremes of sort of collectivism at all costs or individualism at all costs. It's somewhere in the middle, and people have to negotiate how do you integrate the I within the we, what's the relationship between these two things. Everyone's context is different, but I think, again, it's important for conversation, communication, dialogue with parents, your spouse, if you have children, speaking to them about healthy boundaries, what that all looks like and time and place, and things shift and move over time. Sometimes circumstances or specific situations means we are not for, it's not the right time to sort of enforce personal boundaries, and so we have to be a little bit more loose. And then sort of some other times we're afforded based on the context and the situation. And I think it's an evolving practice. There's no one type sort of approach that will work for every situation, but it's sort of encouraging people to try things. Otherwise, if obviously we stick to the same sort of approach for everything, then often the same sort of outcome is going to come. And often that's based on individuals wearing the stresses and the tensions, and there's better ways to alleviating these pressures, particularly through communication with our parents and people around us.
That was the University of Auckland's Asatoa Sampilisi on burnout within the Pacific community.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
Yesterday, the Ministry of Health released its HIV monitoring report to mark World AIDS Day. The report tracks New Zealand's goals towards the country's National HIV Action Plan 2023 to 2030. I spoke to Peter Saxton, an associate professor in the School of Population Health and an HIV researcher at the University of Auckland, about the report and where the country is at in combating HIV transmissions. What is this HIV monitoring report?
Well, the HIV monitoring report is a really important opportunity to reflect on what's going well in the response and what needs to improve. So I guess the context is the government has launched this HIV action plan, which aims to eliminate transmission by 2030 and eliminate stigma. So that's an ambitious goal. We've only got 5 years to go. And I guess the monitoring report has a chance to hold the government accountable for funding services that will get us there, but also community agencies making sure that that investment is going to the right places.
The report shows a decrease of roughly 29% in locally acquired HIV diagnoses since the 2010 baseline, in large part due to investment in HIV prevention. What does investment in HIV prevention look like?
Well, gosh, you know, there's been a revolution in HIV prevention over the last decade. And so, gosh, 20 years ago, we were talking largely about condoms and testing. But since 2015, we've got a range of new tools, and they're biomedical tools. So first of all, we've got a pill called PrEP, which stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis. That's something that people at risk of HIV can take that will virtually eliminate the risk of contracting or acquiring HIV if they take it as prescribed. So that's great. And we also know that if people have acquired HIV, if they get tested and diagnosed early, offered treatment, and achieve what we call an undetectable viral load, so we can't detect the virus in their bloodstream, or it's at very, very low levels, they can't transmit HIV to their sexual partners. And we call that concept UST, which stands for undetectable equals untransmittable. So those are two new tools, I guess, we have in our kit. And on top of that, we've got a range of new testing options. So these days you can order HIV tests online, they can be delivered to your home, or you can go to a range of community settings and get, I guess, tested by your peers, people who are like you, who know your story, and a lot of people find that more accessible and relevant. So we've got a range of new tools, that's exciting. What we need to do is make sure that they're getting to the right people.
Speaking more to that point you just there about these tools getting to the right people, previously released data from the University of Otago's HIV Epidemiology Group shows that despite the drop in HIV diagnoses for European gay and bisexual men, or BGM, the same can't be said for Māori GBM or Takatāpui. Why is this?
Yeah, look, it's a really important point. So first of all, the big success, we've seen a 46% drop in new HIV diagnoses amongst all gay and bisexual men or men who have sex with men. That's great, and we know why that's happening. Our own SPOT study at the University of Auckland, which stands for the Sex and Prevention of Transmission Study, we conducted that in 2022 and again this year in 2025, and we've seen that gay and bisexual men are using those prevention tools more often, which is fantastic. So, for example, PrEP has increased from about 25% of all our participants to about 31% of all our participants. So that's a great increase. But as you say, that success has been uneven. So, for example, for Takatāpui, we've seen new diagnoses not change in the last 10 years. It's been pretty static. So they haven't enjoyed the benefits that other gay and bisexual men have seen over the last 10 years. And also, that increase in PrEP has been more modest. So, yes, PrEP has increased for Takatāpui, but only by about 2%, whereas for non-Takatāpui, that's been about 5 or 6%. So I guess that tells us a couple of things. It means that, yes, prevention works, but only if you can access it. And so what we want to see happening is more testing options that are relevant and timely and accessible for Takatāpui. And we also need to think more carefully about how PrEP might be marketed and accessible to Takatāpui, regardless of where they live and regardless of whether they have access to a GP or a sexual health service close to them. So those are some things that the sector is talking about, and I guess it provides a focus for the next 12 months.
Despite GBM being more susceptible to being diagnosed with HIV, how is the country doing in terms of other areas in which someone can receive an HIV diagnosis, such as through needles or even heterosexual sex?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. And look, New Zealand is probably the envy of the world in our response to HIV control amongst people who inject drugs. And that's because in the late 1980s, government was wise enough to fund needle and syringe exchange programs. And so consequently, we really don't have an HIV epidemic amongst people who inject drugs. It's a real testament to that early policy work and the ongoing funding of needle exchange programs. So that's fantastic. But you're right. So we have HIV transmission amongst heterosexual men and women. It's a smaller part of our epidemic. So we have a concentrated epidemic in key populations like gay and bisexual men, like people who inject drugs. So the number of new diagnoses amongst heterosexual men and women is around about 12 a year in a population, you know, of around 3.4 million New Zealanders. But again, if we've got this ambitious goal to eliminate transmission by 2030, that's got to be true for everybody. So I guess the sector is thinking, how might we approach this part of the epidemic? And I guess it probably requires different tools. We're thinking about antenatal screening. So all people who go through pregnancy ought to be offered an HIV test as part of going through antenatal care. We want to make sure that coverage is really high. And then we need to be smarter. So thinking of where are we likely to find heterosexual New Zealanders who are living with undiagnosed HIV and might not have as good access to primary care. That might include places like emergency departments where blood is already drawn. We could add an HIV test to that. It might be in correctional facilities where people might not have had a good history of access to healthcare. And we also need to think of, I guess, visitors to New Zealand and Aotearoa who come from parts of our Pacific region who are experiencing HIV epidemics right now. We could think of offering them prevention services, access to testing, and make sure they have high-quality access in New Zealand while we're here, which they might not be able to experience back home.
With someone who has HIV, are, I guess, symptoms noticeable, or can they fly under the radar a little bit?
That, again, a great point. So one of the other concerning statistics in the report is we've had 28 AIDS diagnoses in 2024. Now, an AIDS diagnosis means that someone's been living with HIV that's undiagnosed and therefore untreated for quite a number of years. And if that happens, often people turn up in hospital, and in some rare cases, even if they're offered treatment, we won't be able to save them. So it's really important that people who think they've been exposed to HIV seek HIV testing and are offered HIV testing. And once they go on treatment, they can expect their virus to reach these undetectable levels within a few months. That's best for their own health. They can live normal lifespans and healthy lives. And it also means they can't transmit HIV to their sexual partners. So that's one of the priorities as well, is to make sure that everyone who might have been exposed is offered an HIV test. And I guess it speaks to this question of stigma as well. We won't achieve any of this if there's still stigma surrounding HIV. So stigma is really pernicious. It can mean people are reluctant to ask for an HIV test. It might mean that health providers are a bit embarrassed about offering an HIV test. So we need to eliminate stigma as well over the next 5 years. So people don't hesitate, they don't flinch, they don't think there's anything wrong with requesting an HIV test. So people don't end up in those AIDS statistics after a few years.
You briefly touched on it just there and previously in the interview as well, but what further can be done to reach the National HIV Action Plan's 2030 target of a 90% reduction in diagnoses?
Look, it's ambitious, but I think we can get there. And, you know, New Zealand is, again, one of a small number of countries which has kept HIV at low levels throughout our epidemic. And I guess we should reflect on why. That's because of these early-based responses in the 1980s and 1990s. We responded to HIV with science and evidence, not moralism. We took a pragmatic approach, I guess, to the challenge of HIV in people who inject drugs, amongst sex workers, amongst gay and bisexual men. And it was also a bipartisan response, which means that we largely got the approval of all political parties that this was the right way to approach HIV. We shouldn't politicise HIV. That model has largely stayed in place for 30 or 40 years. And it also means that we've put communities who are most at risk at the forefront of the response. So unlike some other areas of health, government tends to fund key communities to lead the response themselves. That's why we have organisations like New Zealand Prostitutes Collective, like the Needle Exchange Programs, and like the Burnett Foundation Aotearoa, which are kind of peer-led community-based organisations. That means they can design really, I guess, relevant, accessible services. You know, they speak the language of communities. So we need to keep that together if we're to achieve those targets. And I guess we just need a bit more energy. So we need to make smarter choices. We all know that there are lots of health problems that the government is struggling to find funds for. HIV is part of that mix. So I think we're showing really good value. No, I think the diagnoses are declining. I think we just need to be a bit smarter over the next 5 years, and we have a chance of achieving that goal of eliminating transmission.
That was the University of Auckland's Peter Saxton on the Ministry of Health's HIV monitoring report that was released yesterday on World AIDS Day.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Kuira te ho taka katoa mo tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou ka I korodo mai ki maua mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, Dr. Kushla McGovern, the National Party's Stuart Smith, the Bioeconomy Science Institute's Sei Wing Yu, and the University of Auckland's Asatoa Sam Pelisi and Peter Saxton. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana, thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.